Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. We talked before the news about Trump economic policies. Now we'll turn to developments in the Russia investigation and this weekend's election, such as it is, in Russia as part of our Democracy World Tour for 2018, where we are following elections in a variety of countries. There are really at least two types of Russia investigations taking place now, the ones about election meddling and the possible involvement of Trump or his associates, of course, and now the one involving the nerve gas attack on a suspected or nerve agent attack on a suspected Russian double agent, a defector named Sergei Skripal in the UK. That one actually got Trump to say something critical about the Russian government, one of the rare times.
It looks like it. I spoke with the prime minister, and we are in deep discussions. A very sad situation. It certainly looks like the Russians were behind it. Something that should never, ever happen. And we're taking it very seriously, as I think are many others.
And with me now is Masha Gessen, staff writer for The New Yorker, who is Russian-American and came here to avoid oppression by Putin's regime. But we'll also ask about her take in The New Yorker that the Russian meddling story is being overblown. Hi, Masha. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Great to be here.
Let's start with the nerve agent attack, which you write was carried out in such a way as to fail to kill the target while still managing to expose as many as 500 other people to the poisonous agent. Are you saying it was designed not to kill the double agent?
Oh, no, I don't think this is incompetence by design. I think this is just incompetence as incompetence.
And what do you make of the clip of Trump that we just played and the sanctions that he finally imposed over election meddling? Do you read it as a sudden burst of toughness on Russia? And if so, pardon my skepticism, do you think it's for a calculated reason related to the progress of the Mueller investigation?
Well, I mean, look, I don't want to engage in conspiracy theorizing, but Trump has, weirdly, probably the best expert on Russia working for the National Security Council as the head of the Russia stuff, Fiona Hill. And I think we should expect Fiona to occasionally get through to the president and for something sane to emerge from the White House. And I think that's what we've just seen. We saw, you know, we heard of a sane statement on Russia and the imposition of sanctions that actually were mandated by Congress and were supposed to go into effect weeks ago. So this is actually, you know, way past deadline and under duress.
There is an election this weekend in Russia that doesn't seem to have much drama attached to it in the Western media. Are we missing anything important?
Well, see, it's hard to talk about the Russian election because we don't have words to talk about the Russian election, because it's an election that's not an election. It's a ritual with a predictable outcome. It has candidates, but only the ones that were picked out by chief candidate himself. It has campaigning, but only, you know, there are debates, but Putin doesn't participate in the debates, and so on. So it's an election in quotes, and everything about it is in quotes. What I think is important to watch, to the extent that we can observe it, is how many people actually go to the polls. Because there's a huge get out the so-called vote effort on the part of the Kremlin to lend legitimacy to the ritual. But there, Alexei Navalny, the anti-corruption activist who was banned from participating in the election as a candidate, has been campaigning for a boycott. And a lot of people are really conflicted because on the one hand, they want to listen to Navalny and they don't want to legitimize this empty ritual. On the other hand, that is really the only chance they get once every 6 years to say something to the Kremlin. And a lot of people are understandably reluctant to give up that chance.
Usually I hear that we may hate Putin as an autocrat and, you know, and label him an autocrat, but he is popular there. Would he win a free and fair election, something that you wouldn't call a so-called election today if he were willing to hold one?
Well, see, that's just the thing. To have a free and fair election, you would need to have regime change in Russia. because the problem is not simply that the votes are counted poorly, or that candidates are not allowed on the ballot. The problem is that the entirety of Russian media is dominated by the Kremlin, that there has been a complete disappearance of public space. So it's not like you could suddenly sort of throw this thing open. You really need to reform the country and to return people to the possibility of even having a political conversation.
And listeners, our phones are open for Masha Gessen for anything you want to ask or say about Russia or the Russia investigation or the attack in the UK. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You wrote an article in The New Yorker this week called "Putin Outwitted Megyn Kelly by Weaponizing Incompetence." And you use this example. Putin claimed not to know about any individual Russians who might have meddled in the U.S. presidential election, including anyone in his government who might have done so, to which Kelly followed up like this.
You're up for re-election right now. Should the Russian people be concerned that you had no idea this was going on in your own country, in your own hometown?
Listen, the world is very large and very diverse, and there is a fairly complicated relationship between the United States and the Russian Federation. And some of our people have their own opinion about this relationship.
So, Masha, the deep sigh from Putin at the beginning of that answer didn't even need a translator. Why did you single out that exchange?
It was actually hard to find an exchange to single out. There was a lot of priceless stuff in the interview. And actually, one of the things that interested me most about the interview was that a lot of it was just lost in translation, quite literally. I think they had two interpreters, maybe they had three at one point, but they were switching off. And one of the interpreters, the female interpreters, it happens, just didn't understand what Megyn Kelly was saying and wasn't very good at interpreting what Putin was saying back to her. So she kept making pretty catastrophic translation mistakes. And in fact, in that exchange, when Putin said, "You think the world is obsessed with you," meaning the United States thinks that the world is obsessed with, that the world revolves around the United States, she translated so that Megyn Kelly understood it as, "You think that the world revolves around Megyn Kelly."
Hmm. So purpose, you're saying that the Putin translator who was there on the set for a network interview was purposely mistranslating the words of a head of state? No.
No, not at all. No. I think there's purposeful incompetence, there's weaponized incompetence, and then there's just genuine incompetence. And they do go hand in hand. I mean, Putin professes ignorance and makes himself completely unaccountable. And but it's not, you know, it's not a lie. It's not a lie that he doesn't know what's going on in his own administration. It's not a lie that that it's one of the most poorly managed organizations I have ever seen in my life, right? It's just that he manages to sort of to weaponize it the way that a failing student will just sort of, shrug his shoulders and say, "Well, I'm not, you know, I didn't get it done." But then there's genuine incompetence, which actually is part of this weaponized incompetence.
And you contrast that in your article with the Trump administration's real incompetence, also on display, but not as effectively weaponized, on 60 Minutes when Leslie Stahl asked Education Secretary Betsy DeVos this.
Have you seen the really bad schools? Maybe try to figure out what they're doing?
I have not intentionally visited schools that are underperforming.
Maybe you should.
Maybe I should, yes.
Real incompetence.
Really? Well, see, they're both really incompetent. It's just that Betsy DeVos is not that good at, she's performing competence instead of performing incompetence.
Yes.
but, in a couple of years, she'll be able to say, "I have intentionally not visited schools that are underperforming."
Although after your article came out, just to torture this metaphor one more step, Trump admitted at that fundraiser that he purposely claimed to the Canadian Prime Minister that we have a trade deficit with them without knowing if it's true. He made a statement purposely to another head of state, clearly without knowing it's true, and boasted that he did that. That sounds like weaponizing incompetence to me.
He's a quick study in that area.
Let's take a phone call. Tracy in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Masha Gessen. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Tracy.
What is the correlation between Russia's denying categorically it did not cheat in the Olympics for however many years and the movie Icarus and the way the Kremlin is denying it's not using nerve gas?
Icarus, which, by the way, won the Academy Award for Best Feature-Length Documentary.
You're exactly right to put these things in the same category. I mean, these are blatant lies. And in a way, they're very similar to what Putin does. You know, he says, you know, this didn't happen, or I don't know this. And he makes himself sort of blankly unaccountable. This is the same thing. It is obvious that they're lying. And lying obviously actually has an incredible amount of power because there's nothing you can do about it.
Did you think, and we had the filmmakers on, before the Oscar ceremony, we interview all of the nominees for Best Feature-Length Documentary on this show. That's how nerdy we are. But it was really interesting to talk to those filmmakers, you know, who had kind of stumbled on this Russian. They were trying to make a whole other film, and they kind of stumbled on this Russian who seemed to be significant leader of the doping regime for Olympic athletes. Did you see the movie?
I did.
And what is it? What's your what do you take away from it that our listeners can learn from?
I thought it was fascinating because this guy was so clearly full of himself and an unreliable narrator, and I don't think, you know, I think
the
Americans,
the Russian doping guy,
I thought actually the interactions between him and the filmmaker are very touching and very telling in sort of the way that Americans sometimes have trouble interpreting what Russians have to say because his unreliability, I think, was not so clear to the filmmaker, right? And but I think that, you know, for a reporter to actually be gullible in a measured way is a great reporting technique, and I think the movie worked very well for that.
Sergey in Queens, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Masha. Доброе утро. So I know that recently President Putin made a statement about Jews, Tatars, and Ukrainians, which was very unnerving. And it reminds me of once in a while, you know, we read that there's some viable opposition on the local and regional level in Russia. So I wanted to know your take. I mean, is there any opposition activity when it comes to, like, local or municipal politics in Russia? And I have relatives in Chelyabinsk. They're Jewish. They're okay. But what about the Tatars? I mean, how are they doing in today's Russia?
You know, using the word opposition in relationship to Russia is almost as tricky as using the word election, because the moment that we say opposition, it implies that people have the tools of organizing, you know, access to media, the ability to act together in a political way. None of that is true. And so I really try to stay away from using the word opposition. I think there are some very brave individuals who have done very brave things. On the municipal level, in Moscow in particular, in the last election, they managed to pull off some interesting results. They're not, to call it opposition, to call it politics would be really overstating the facts, but they're managing to be a pain in the Kremlin's side, and I think that's saying a lot considering just how repressive Russia has become. But as for the comment that Putin made about Jews, Tatars, and Ukrainians, there's been a lot of discussion in sort of Russia studies circles about it, whether it should be interpreted as an anti-Semitic comment or not. I think it should be. Part of it was also a translation problem because the translator, it was that particular interpreter whom I've mentioned, who kept confusing the words for Russian the word that means Russian citizen and the word that means ethnic Russian. But Putin has enough sophistication to tell the difference. He knew what the context was. He used the bad translation to try to imply that it could be enemies, non-Russians, right? And so he chose three quintessential non-Russian groups, Ukrainians, with whom Russia is at war, Tatars, who are Muslim, and Jews, who are, you know, Jews. And so in that sense, I think it was a xenophobic comment, a sort of, you know, run-of-the-mill xenophobic deflection.
And that was in relation to the meddling in the U.S. election, right? So, like, Trump says, oh, I don't know if it was Russia, maybe it was China, maybe it was a 400-pound guy on his couch. He was saying, I don't know if it was Russians, maybe it was ethnic non-Russians from Russia who opposed the regime, Jews, Tatars, and Ukrainians. It was that context.
Exactly, exactly. And maybe they even have a green card. So maybe they're not Russian in any sense of the word.
Richard in Harrison, you're on WNYC with Masha Gessen. Hi, Richard.
Yes, hi. How you doing?
Okay.
You know, to me, all of this is the height of hypocrisy. The United States, throughout its history, has been involved in numerous coups. And to now, you know, have a problem with what the Russians have been doing, it's just so hypocritical. I mean,
but Richard, the media, the American media, and certainly American democracy advocates and the American left have had a big problem and have articulated the big problem with the U.S. empire when the U.S. has acted like an empire. So wouldn't the single standard be to also call it out and be concerned if Russia is trying to interfere in Western democracies all over the place?
I'm much more concerned about the lying that goes on with our parties. You know, the lying that each party engages in, disseminating false information about candidates from the opposition party. I'm much more concerned about that than I am whatever the Russians are up to. I mean, the espionage, there'll always be espionage, so you can forget that. I'm much more concerned with how we've degenerated into a country where the truth doesn't matter at all anymore. It's just winning and at any cost. So I'm much more concerned about what our own politicians are doing and candidates are doing, mm-hmm. and the parties are doing, and the lying right. they're doing, than about the Russians.
Richard, I gotcha. And Masha, for people who don't know the context, I mean, they hear Richard for Richard, but the context of you is that you wrote just a few days ago in The New Yorker that you believe the stories of Russian meddling in our election are real, but nevertheless, you think the U.S. media sometimes makes too much of the story. So am I summarizing that right? And how does that intersect with Richard's concern, if it does?
I somewhat agree with Richard. I mean, I wouldn't engage in sort of the whataboutism about the U.S. meddling in other countries' elections, although I think it's a really interesting question. You know, how are we going to, in a global world, in a completely interconnected world, we can't really say that foreign interest and foreign investment, foreign participation and attempts to influence an election are a priori bad, right, or unjustified. So there has to be a much more subtle, much more interesting case made about Russia that actually involves delving into the U.S.-Russian relationship and the nature of the Russian regime, which is something that the U.S. has been reluctant to do for many years. But yes, I mean, you know, believe one can't believe or not believe facts, right? We can't argue about facts. So yes, to the extent that we know what happened, of course it's real, right? But I think that the focus on it, on the Mueller investigation in particular, tends to obscure the fact that it's Americans who elected Trump. And if Russians influenced American public opinion, it was still American public opinion that they influenced. And we're still stuck in a country where a large enough plurality of citizens wanted Trump to become president.
I wonder, though, if it's worth breaking the Russian meddling into two distinct categories. One being maybe the more troublesome, the dissemination of fake news. So if Americans were manipulated into thinking things about Hillary Clinton or whatever the fake news content was that caused more people to vote for Trump, then it really isn't just on the American people. But if Russia, like any other agent of opposition research, revealed the John Podesta emails and the DNC emails, and they were real and people had a reaction to them, that's somehow less serious, even though that's what so much of the focus of the Mueller investigation seems to be.
That's really interesting because I think it's exactly the opposite. I think that hacking the DNC servers is, you know, it's a clearly illegal act. It's a clearly hostile act. I think that I mean, I think that the fact that they were real doesn't justify sort of the fact that they're fruits of a poison tree. They're products of criminal behavior, right? And I think that the fact that they ended up in the public space is actually hugely problematic. As for fake news, I think we would actually in the end be hard pressed to separate, you know, the fake news created by Moscow or St. Petersburg, as the case may be, from the fake news created by Macedonian teenagers. And are the fake news created by Macedonian teenagers somehow less bad than the fake news created by St. Petersburg? They're not more sophisticated.
But wait, why wouldn't we see those as different? The Macedonian teenagers, for people who don't know, young people in Macedonia and probably elsewhere figured out that there was money to be made online by disseminating fake critical stories about Hillary Clinton. So that's one category. If the Russian government is doing it as a matter of official Russian activity to disrupt the American election and try to cause one outcome over another, that's pretty different, isn't it?
It is in terms of the U.S.-Russian relationship, but it is not in terms of our understanding what happened with the election here.
So you have written that that you don't think the Russian meddling will turn out to be a hoax, or that it will provide enough evidence of something to lead to impeachment. Why suspect that or tend to conclude that before Mueller has announced how many dots he will be able to connect?
Oh, because it's hard to avoid temptation. I mean, it would probably be prudent for all of us to sit on our hands and wait until he releases all his information. But, you know, I can't help making
it's
a guess.
Just where it seems to you that it's likely headed and not headed.
What we've seen so far, and you know, the original Joint Intelligence Report points to, and what I know actually about the way that both the Russian administration functions and what we know about the way that Trump functions, I think in the end it's very unlikely that we will see solid evidence of direct connections.
There is one new piece in the last day, according to the New York Times, that Mueller has subpoenaed Russia-related documents from Trump's business, the Trump Organization. Do you see any significance to that? Have you looked at that?
Well, we know, and actually your own podcast, Trump Inc., is the absolute best thing on Trump's businesses. I think we have some idea of what we're likely to see there, right? We're likely to see a lot of Russian money that was laundered through Trump properties. But then the question is, can we make the argument that means that Trump was beholden to Russians? And I think that considering that we're talking about a man who never paid his debts and who never actually acted beholden to anybody, who wouldn't even reimburse his own lawyer for his out-of-pocket hush money to Stormy Daniels, making the argument that he's beholden, that he acts in a particular way because he's in debt, actually strains credulity.
But is he acting in a way that strikes you as him being beholden to Russia or to Putin for something?
No, I think that he probably sincerely admires Putin and wants to be him when he grows up.
Doesn't just like Putin, he wants to be like Putin.
Yes.
One more call. Linda in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda.
Oh, good morning. Masha Gessen, you're my heroine.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank you for nearly 2 years ago having gone on NPR in several interviews and warned the American people that we lacked imagination, in other words, to imagine that it was likely that Donald Trump could become president. And I've never forgotten you for that.
Thank you, Linda.
You're welcome. That's all I wanted to say.
Oh, okay. And so I'll finish by asking you about another thing that you said right after the election, which was when you put out a lot of things. You said you put out a seminal article, and I think a lot of people consider it that, that was like rules for the American people for dealing with autocrats based on your own experiences watching Putin. So how's American democracy doing by your lights here a year plus in?
I'm not terribly optimistic. But, and I think that if there's one thing I can say, I think that we keep focusing on how well American institutions have held up over the course of a year.
Like the media is still pushing back, the courts are still being independent.
Right. But that's not what we should be looking at. Because the fact that institutions built up over the course of 200 years are going to continue to function for some number of years, that's something we should take for granted. What we really need to be focusing on are the losses, right? And I think that there's major losses in public conversation, in just the sort of the credibility of government and the relationship between the government and the media, and of course deregulation, which is really the role of government in society.
Masha Gessen, New Yorker staff writer and author of books including her latest, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Masha, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.